first questions were actually in your article, is that it mentions here at the top, it says that the model was great success. Currents of 10 amps were achieved.
Let me see it. That could be a misprint. Let me find it.
At the top of the second column?
You know, I don't know, but the person to ask is Keith Simon,
yeah,
the one who can't drive. Ask him. He will know.
Okay.
Somewhere there's a publication that might actually say that does seem extremely high.
Yeah, if you look on the, I think it's the second page,
yeah,
it has that chart of the specs of tantalus.
Yeah, but see, there's a difference. This is tantalus.
Mm-hmm.
This thing here is not.
Oh.
This is the injector for it.
Okay.
And the currents there will be higher.
Okay.
But whether they can be that high or not, I don't know. So it's a different machine. And let's see if there's a drawing. Yeah, this is not it. It's over here.
Okay, it's...
And it's about equal size, but different shape. And it's pulsed, and the pulses could, in fact, be 10-amp pulses, but I'm not sure. That does sound high to me. And T. Simon will know for sure, because he actually worked with it.
So where does the energy loss then? Because...
The current's lost?
Yeah.
Because it doesn't get captured in the other machine.
You okay.
Throw, it's like... shooting a big hose and trying to get water in a quarter inch diameter pipe. Some goes in and much goes out. So you miss it, it gets lost.
Got it.
Or it goes in this case, it goes in and doesn't get captured and it hits the walls.
And then there's one other technical question I had. The grazing incidence region, can
yeah.
you tell me about that?
In words, it's easier to draw it.
Sure.
If I just make a plot of let's see, how do I want to do this? Normally I would put the energy this way, and it means the wavelength goes this way. And this region, long wavelength, is the infrared.
Mm-hmm.
And then they have visible. And then we have the ultraviolet. Then we have what's called the vacuum ultraviolet. I'll address each of these in a minute. And then it gets into soft X-ray. These are not sharp lines.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and the problem is if I talk about a mirror to move the radiation around, if I use one that comes in like this, and that's normal incidence, and the other, it would be to come in at a big angle and come off like that, and that's grazing incidence.
Okay.
And the reason you have to have both is in this region, in this region, and sort of in this region, you can use this because it reflects maybe
yeah.
90%. But as soon as you get somewhere down in here, it starts to reflect 80, 70, 60, 50, 40, down to nothing. And so you use this instead.
So the shallower angle
yeah,
allows it
reflects,
to...
Yeah, let's say 90%. Don't hold me to any of the numbers. But here it can be as high as 90%, here, here, and here. In
okay.
fact, infrared, you can do 98, 99% with ordinary cheap mirror. And so somewhere in here you have to switch. There's actually
mm-hmm.
an intermediate range that some people use. They use it down here. But that's all it means.
Okay.
And it's because it you could also call the same region the soft X-ray region.
And what about the vacuum ultraviolet?
Well, that's called that because oxygen and nitrogen molecules, which make up 90% of air, absorb completely.
Oh, okay.
And you couldn't get the radiation to go a centimeter. And so you have to pump the entire light path out. And it has to be really pretty good vacuum just to get the light to travel from here to that wall. But on the other hand, a lot of the experiments here, people want much better vacuum than that to
mm-hmm.
keep their sample clean. But yeah, you have to have a vacuum there.
Got it. You had mentioned that there were a lot of upgrades to tantalus, and one of them was an improved vacuum
pump.
So maybe you could talk about some of the upgrades that
What did I say? Let me see what I said.
It may, probably third page, or maybe the second page.
Where are we here? Second.
Yeah, page. It'd be the third page. Third to fourth page, I believe so.
Early experience difficult because of low injection currents. True. Focusing very new on our... They said it's able to vacuum. Oh, it's okay, here we come to instrumentation. Well, essentially, all the instruments on this and on Tantalus have to be evacuated.
Mm-hmm.
Or if they're not, the air or gas, whatever is in there, will go back into the ring and it'll scatter the electrons into the wall,
mm-hmm.
and the current will go to nothing very fast. In fact, that happened back incidentally at least twice up there. One time it was with chlorine gas, and it really caused a big problem. Just a minute. More serious than scanning, we're gonna get fixed. I'm not sure what I say about vacuum. I haven't found anything about vacuum. I mean, the original vacuum was pretty good. In Tantalus, it wasn't as good as in here, but some of the early users, they had pretty good vacuum. Mm-hmm. As good as people here, I'm not sure what that means. Well, one thing about this is that this has the problem that you have to make the beam line longer.
Mm-hmm.
See, this folds back on itself. And so the geometry is very different. And there's two more problems with it. One is when you go with grazing incidence off something, whether it's a grating or a subsequent mirror, the imaging is terrible. In other words, if you were to use a camera lens and you take a picture, you get an image that looks like the real object.
Mm-hmm.
But if you make yourself a really big lens and you look around the periphery, you get to see some distortion. You do it with this, you get terrible distortion.
Okay.
And in the case of the instruments down here, that translates to having very little light come through, much less than is there, because it's supposed to come out of a small region and most of it's hitting the wall around it. And so, whereas this one, the imaging is very good. So that's a big problem with this, but again, you have no choice. And then the third thing is, it's necessary, in order to get just a little piece of this spectrum,
mm-hmm.
which is what many experiments want, what you have to do is disperse the light. So here what's coming in is white light.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's actually ultraviolet, but it's all color, all wavelength. And then this might be some sort of a curved grating, which focuses it right here on a slit, and the red would be here, and the blue would be here, and the ultraviolet here. And then you want to scan this, or move this. You have to move something in order to have the wavelength that you want come out the slit. So in the early, some early instruments would move the slit. But if you move the slit, then you have to move the whole experiment behind the slit.
Yeah.
That's awkward and hard. And so what has to be done to scan this without moving the slit, to keep it focused, there's a big circle in space. This is just a mathematical circle.
Mm-hmm.
And one slit has to be on it, the other slit has to be on it, the grating has to be on it, and it has to have a radius of curvature equal to the diameter of this thing. So, and once you do that, then when you scan, you have to rotate this and move it a little bit along the circle. And you can do that. Originally they did that with a motor and a screw that pushed this,
mm-hmm.
and rotated it, and a cam that did the translation. With this, it's much, much harder to do that. And some of the designs down here, they actually move the entrance slit back and forth and translate and rotate this a little bit. So this is much, much harder to work with for many reasons.
Okay.
But Tantalus didn't have such a need for it because the electrons were at lower energy,
mm-hmm.
and they didn't produce as fierce soft X-rays as this one does. And no hard X-rays, and this produces a little bit down here.
Okay. Also, in terms of energy and current, So what dictates each one? What does a higher energy dictate?
And if then the energy of the electrons in the storage ring is higher, you get some light at wavelengths that are shorter than you could get before. So that's the main reason people want higher energy.
Okay.
If they want to go to shorter wavelengths, it doesn't benefit the people who are working down here. In fact, it may cause them some grief because some of this will get into their instrumentation and they don't want it. The current, whatever energy you've got, if you increase the current, you usually increase the amount of light coming out
so
in an experiment.
The amplitude?
Yeah,
okay.
The flux. I mean, it's like standing out in the sun on a cloudy day versus a clear day. You get a sunburn a lot faster than a cloudy day, the clear day. Again, it isn't just current, because to get a bigger current, the beam gets bigger in diameter. Actually, it's not round, it's elliptical. Then when you focus that on this entrance slit, not all of it may get through. And so a bigger current usually means more light on the experiment. If you double the current, you may not get double the light. You might get 1.8 times more light. Yes. So the current is to get more light, and the energy of the electrons is to give a different quality of light. It gives you a wavelength range you don't have at lower energy.
Got it. And as I'm learning all the relative units of energies and things, can you explain the vacuum units of torr?
Yeah, we're not supposed to use that.
No?
An Italian named Torricelli invented a barometer. So it's named after him. One torr equals, is 1 millimeter of mercury in a barometer. And so one atmosphere is about 760 torr.
Okay.
On the other hand, there's nobody in this country who uses very few use the metric system for pressures.
And is that Pascal?
It's Pascal's,
okay.
Yeah.
But even the SINCRT SRC.
Some people around here use it, but not very many.
Well, Chris had explained that the SRC here is measured in torrs.
Yeah.
And so it said here, none of them had a vacuum better than 2 times 10 to the negative 8 torr.
Oh, there we go. Let's see that.
It's right there.
Okay. Oh, that was true. Yeah, okay. Yeah, that's true. That was our number. That was what we had. It's what the Chicago people had. A couple of years ago, right at the very beginning. Okay, and then about the third or fourth instrument on there was factor 2 better. Factor 10 to the 2, factor 100 better. Yeah, that's because they weren't built before there were storage rings. There were monochrometers that people use for vacuum ultraviolet. And their light sources were gas discharges, sort of like a neon sign, but inside a usually metallic tube, with hydrogen or helium gas. And those were bolted directly to the vacuum, to the monochrometer, and sometimes they even put a window there, so the gas couldn't get into the monochrometer, or they would put a section. If they didn't want a window because it would absorb, they would put a section where they had a couple of small apertures and they had a couple of extra vacuum pumps there. So the pressure was pretty high in the lamp, then it got lower, then it got lower here, lower there, and then you had to have a pressure of about 10 to the minus 5 torr in the monochrometer just to get the light to go the distance.
Okay.
And not be absorbed. And 10 to the minus 8 was what we got because ours had materials in it that you shouldn't be using in a really good vacuum. It had brass, it had some probably lubricated rubber O-rings. They should be Viton, which is a polymer that doesn't outgas so much as rubber. The grating was on some sort of epoxy base, which was gassy. There was pencil writing on the back. That's got a organic binder. So there are materials in there that limited it. And we, and the other thing is we couldn't bake it. Normally, you, to get a really good vacuum, you, you heat it to over 100 Celsius. And that's to drive the water vapor off. Mm-hmm. And actually to drive some hydrogen out of the stainless steel. Because if you don't do that, the hydrogen will gradually come out. Mm-hmm. Hydrogen's not too bad to have in there, but the water is. So they're typically baked, and ours had things that couldn't be baked. The grating would have warped if we had baked it, for example. So we couldn't do better than 10 to the minus 8.
So it was 10 to the minus 8, though, pretty respectable in terms of?
Not now and not here. We couldn't get away with it here. We'd need a window if we're going to do that here. Well, it's better than people used to use in those same amount of chromometers, yeah.
Okay.
About a factor of 100 better, but... it's nothing to be proud of, and your surfaces will get contaminated with water vapor and oxygen and before you can do any measurements whatsoever. Really fast.
All right. I guess that's all my technical questions. Maybe you could just tell me about when you came here, when you started here, what your role was, anything that major that comes
to
mind.
Well, I came here the first time. Before there was a storage ring, but there were some tape or chalk or paint on the floor that indicated where the magnets were going to go.
Mm-hmm.
But they didn't have money to finish it. The injector, the so-called model, was built and running. And they then wanted to build a storage ring to study the phenomenon of large bunches of electrons traveling around in a vacuum with focusing magnets and bending magnets to see what the effects were of the fact that the electrons are all repelling one another.
Mm-hmm.
But can you really keep them together for significant amounts of time? And the National Academy of Sciences occasionally appoints study committees, and they appointed one. This guy Fred Brown was on it. And they recommended that the storage ring be funded enough to be finished and used as a light source, that two ports be added that where the radiation could come out. Originally, they weren't there. It would be all stainless steel and you wouldn't see anything. And at some point, the Air Force agreed to fund it, and they did, and it was built, and it had two ports on. But the ports were actually useless because they were just windows. You could put your eye there and see the light, but it wasn't a wise thing to do. It looked like a welder's arc.
Yeah.
Very bright, like a dazzling blue star. And so, let's see, I'm not sure who did it. I think University of Chicago and University of Illinois both funded building focusing mirrors because your monochromator slits here, the light source is at the tangent inside the ring and it's 2 or 3 meters between them. And so you needed to build a box that would collect this light and focus it there.
Mm-hmm.
And that sort of had to be, it wasn't an easy thing. The vacuum can was fine. They knew how to do that with stainless steel. The trick was to make a mirror, grazing incidence mirror, because it had to go to more or less a straight line. And it had to be smoother than normal mirrors because the wavelengths were shorter. So the amount of scattering you will get, the things that scatter the light the most off a mirror or any other surface are surface imperfections that are of the order of a wavelength in size. And if you make the wavelength smaller, then the smaller ones are important. And the larger ones are still important because they simply deflect the beam almost geometrically out of it. So they had to be a really good mirror. And they developed some technology here for making your own mirrors. That was done over in the PSL shop. And one beam line was put on with a focusing mirror. That was the first one. That was, I think that was Chicago's, I'm not sure. I am not sure about which mirror box went on, but I think it was Chicago, anyway. And we were going to use theirs afterward. And the other one was Fred Brown's, and he put an instrument on that. But you couldn't work very well because there was almost no light. They had real trouble learning how to inject the electrons and capture them.
Mm-hmm.
And the currents were very, very small. And it was a long time before anybody, I mean, it was, I suppose, months before somebody got any useful data. And that was this guy over at Gebhardt, who was a postdoc in Chicago. And he got the first data. And then the Illinois people did. And then we did. And then IBM came and built another beamline. So that was the third. And there really wasn't any room for any more because the building wall came awfully close to the storage ring. And mm-hmm. you couldn't get anything in between it and the wall at the angle and at where it had to go. So I think they ran with three beamlines for a while, and people changed instrumentation on the end. And then they got money for an increase in size of the building, although it wasn't an enormous increase. What they did was the building was half underground. Mm-hmm. The north side, if that's north, the north side and the west side were earth, and it was a concrete wall, and the east side too. And then the south side had a big garage overhead door that you walked in there to get in there. There was a stairway for pedestrians elsewhere, but it wasn't used much. So what they could do is they could move the garage door out further in the driveway, and they excavated on the west and a little of the north side down to floor level, but they left the wall there. And then they built a roof to go across and match it, and only then did they worry about taking the wall down. And during that time was when the Montana State people had a beamline on, and they had a company picnic, and they had a tornado, and they had a terrific windstorm, and the roof wasn't sealed because it was under construction. And they had a foot or two of water.
Was that the
floor.
G.J. LaPierre Award story?
Award
Jim Taylor told me this.
Because LaPierre came out here and waded in the water, pick up a lot of his cables, which were on the floor. You know, they're connected with screw connectors.
Yeah.
And he had to take them apart and dry them. And it didn't seem to worry him that there are 110 volt, 220, 440
yeah.
volt cables under there too. And he could have been electrocuted, but he had to explain himself to the, I think they had firemen, we had sheriff's deputies, and maybe police too. It was a mess. I mean, his toolbox was full of water. And then when he finished, he started working on other people's stuff to drain the water out. He's still around. He's a very
yeah.
colorful guy. He's not an Indian, but he grew up on a ranch surrounded, he said, by an Indian reservation. Went to a one-room log cabin grade school.
Wonderful. That's a great start. Are there any big moments that you had at Tantalus that you can recall?
In what way?
You worked on with the beamlines, right, for research?
Well, yeah, I mean, okay, this is another interesting story. 1967, I guess I decided we would do this, and we started buying stuff. And we brought our monochrometer up. I'm trying to figure out what the time scale. Yeah, in the fall of spring of 68, I think we brought something up here. And I think forget the date is probably in there because I checked it. When the first time they had current, it was probably summer of 68, maybe fall, maybe the fall. Anyway, we set up as best we could without a mirror box and got everything working. And I had came up with two graduate students. Then I took a sabbatical. I was in Hamburg for the fall of 68, part of 69, spring of 69, and I was in Rome of 69 till June. And then I came back up here, and then we started getting a little light through, and we actually didn't do any experiments. We just wanted to get light out, monochromatic light mm-hmm. out, and detect it. And once that was done, we had a sample chamber we'd built, and we started measuring reflectances of metals, and that went pretty well. But I mean, that was not a technically difficult experiment. People had done it with conventional light sources, these helium and hydrogen discharges. But I forget when, sometime in the 70s, early 70s, we started what's called modulation spectroscopy, where you do something to your sample in a periodic fashion. You oscillate its temperature up and down, or squeeze on it, or apply an electric voltage to it that oscillates at some low frequency, maybe in the audio frequency range, and look at how that modifies the reflectance. And you detect only the modulated part. And people thought there was nothing to see in this spectral range, that everything would be, all the structures of the type you saw in the visible would be broadened so much you wouldn't see anything. And it turns out that wasn't true. We could see a lot. So that was pretty good when we first started seeing that. The first time we tried, we picked something we thought would give a huge signal. And to this day, I don't know why we didn't see anything, but we did somewhat later on other things. So that was probably the best thing and most unusual thing we did there.
Okay. You had just left off before saying that the Tantalus building was expanded.
Yeah.
So that
allowed some more, and then we had our own beamline.
Okay.
Yeah, that allowed quite a few more. I think there were eight, something like that. And we had our own, which we shared with LaPere. And then I think we had to give a certain number of weeks a year to some external user who didn't own one. But we had little control over that, because if we could supply the user and somebody we liked and trusted and all that, then that counted. They wouldn't inflict somebody on us.
Mm-hmm.
Some weird things happened. I mean, we did let some guy in the physics department here look at a reflectance from an organic crystal. And the crystal was a lot smaller when he finished than when he started. It evaporated inside our monochromator,
mm-hmm.
presumably coating our gradient. And that was not good.
So how many beamlines were there afterwards?
I think there were eight. But then they learned to split them. And you couldn't necessarily split them actively, but you could have two connected, and the mirror would send light to one or the other, but mm-hmm. not both. But that meant that they could share a 16-hour day, or they could alternate weeks and not have to break back. So it sort of evolved as time went on.
So when they split it, did that affect the...
No, because a lot of people weren't using all of the available angle that was there. So typically it was wasted in the beginning.
Hmm. Okay. Maybe we can move ahead to when the SRC came around this building. I mean, were you here for most of the... Okay.
Yeah.
A big hole in what I've found from the interviews is the start of Aladdin here. And usually it just says, and then Aladdin was built, and then, the rest is history. So,
well, they always wanted to build another storage ring. I mean, that one, Tantalus, wasn't built as a light source.
Mm-hmm.
It was built to study electrons in storage rings. And so they wanted to build one, and other people were building one. And they had several proposals. I mean, I don't know how many proposals from here. I don't know what they called the first one. I don't think it was ever submitted. And there was an Aladdin proposal. There was a Super Aladdin. There was another one that didn't have a name. None of those got funded except the Aladdin one. But that's a bad story. I mean, they went to NSF with a proposal, and they had to do some generation of excitement among the community, and they did that. So they got lots of potential users to write letters, and maybe university presidents to write letters, and they got the money. The guy who was in charge was Ed Rowe, from this building is built. In my statement, which is an exaggeration, is that he wanted to build it himself for $75 out of spare parts. He was indeed trying to do it almost alone. He did not have very many people working for him. Mike Green was one of them, who's still here. And Charlie Pruitt is another who's on the list, and he's retired, but he lives around here. And they were getting way, way behind, and they were getting currents of microamps, not even a milliamp. They built a an injector for it, which was the world's largest of its type, and that worked beautifully, but they couldn't capture the stuff. And we had a users meeting here, I think it was in October, I forget what year, and it was clear that they were in trouble. There were people here from NSF, and it was clear that Roe would not ask for any more money for more employees. The money would come initially from the University of Wisconsin. And so I was chair of the Users Advisory Committee, and we said he's got to get help. And I told him, this was Saturday, that if he didn't see the president, or what I used to call chancellor here, on Monday to get money, then I would do it on Tuesday. Mm-hmm. And apparently he did go Monday because he called me. And they hired, put a few more people, well, they didn't, they took a few people from PSL to work, but they also agreed they would hire a few. And it still didn't go. There was a problem, and they did not know what the problem was. They did not get the current any higher than whatever, the 75 microamps or something. And at some point, it was already called Aladdin, and at some point, NSF said, if you don't get, I forget what the current was, by such and such a date, funding's over right at that date. And that's often a sign that some people should look for a job right then and there rather than try to get it running. But the university guaranteed their salaries for one calendar year from that date. And that was a nice thing. And nobody left, and they kept working on it. And then, I don't know how it came to be, but they brought in Keith Simon temporarily as director, and they got me to come up as associate director. And I live in Ames, mm-hmm. Iowa, and I came up here by, I had two university rental cars, one I kept to go to the Des Moines airport, and one I kept to get from this one, go back and forth. There were direct flights from Des Moines to here then, so I could get up here, and I was here about 3.5 days a week for 6 months, and we hired, I don't know, 7 people in 9 months, something like that. But it was more than that. I mean, this was taken out of its hands. So we put out a plea to Lawrence Berkeley Lab, where they have a lot of accelerator people. They sent, I think they sent about 6 people here to look around. And then they sent some for to spend some time here. A guy named Yang Lai Cho from Argonne, another accelerator guy, he came up here and stayed weeks, week after week after week. He went on weekends. And one of the people that this building, by the way, wasn't completed inside at the time. One of the people that Keith Simon hired had an idea for what was happening in there. And they said that the problem's kind of interesting. When the electrons go in, there are some gas molecules there bouncing around. And when they hit the molecule, they typically will knock an electron off. And it's positively charged. So the molecules still bounce around, but some of them are molecule ions that are positively charged. The electrons are going down the middle. Well, the ions get attracted to the middle part. And so they spend a little more time there. And so they were what was stopping the beam. And if you think of ions as being a plasma, a gas of ionized particles, it has some sort of resonant frequency where it'll swing back and forth. They had some electrodes in there for monitoring something, monitoring the beam, and they said, let's put an alternating voltage on that at the plasma frequency. We don't know what it is, but we can scan. And that will make them move, and their fastest motion will be in the middle, and they won't spend much time there because they're moving fast. And lo and behold, they got a factor of 100 or so increase.
Oh, wow.
With only some of these working, and they didn't even cover the whole ring. What were left out of the ring were what are called clearing electrodes. And section by section, and over the next months, they put clearing electrodes in there, and then the currents went right up. But NSF had the curious psychological problem that the original Tantalus was advertised as running at 1 ampere.
Yeah.
And it didn't go anywhere near 1 ampere, but nobody wanted it to run 1 ampere. To run 1 ampere, you get a big fat beam, and you can't use most of that light. The Department of Energy built a similar ring at Brookhaven National Lab, called the National Synchrotron Light Source, and they also advertised 1 ampere before they built it. And they had people come from DOE occasionally, and they would show off by running in 800 milliamps, which is almost an ampere. Once they really hit an ampere. But the users down on the floor, some of them didn't pay any attention to that. They didn't use the beam. They waited until it decayed to 400 or something. It was too unstable. I mean, they get noise. Yeah. So anyway, they got up to 250, I guess, in a relatively short time. So yeah, it was a really sad history. I mean, it was tough.
And that's the current that they still run today.
Right. Yeah, 280, yeah. It's probably a little better now, but. And they've learned, this one injected much more tantalus. It was, well, I didn't mention this, back when the early days when we had our first instrument there, they had a crew up in the control room for 40 hours a week, but we might get only 2 hours a beam per week, and we didn't know which 2 hours they were going to be. Mm-hmm. It was just so hard to inject into it. They gradually, over the course of a couple of years, got it. They had another big problem. Their magnets. The magnets here, they're all electromagnets everywhere. The magnets here are powered by probably solid state DC direct current taken from the power lines and by silicon technology converted to DC, and it's pretty reliable. Up there, they had what they called amplodynes, and these are motor generator sets, big things, probably 12 feet long and about this big around. One end was a giant motor with a shaft that went into the other end, which was a generator. The motor was AC and the generator made the DC. Well, the bearings went out on those a lot. And the bearings, they apparently, I don't know if they could put them in themselves or not, but they had to order them and maybe some guy had to come out. Anyway, bearings going down might cost a week or more, and they couldn't do anything. So that was a problem, and they never, I don't know if they ever replaced those amplodynes or not. Somebody might know, but I don't. So in a 40-hour week up there, in the early days, you got 1 or 2 hours a week. And in a good week later, when they were running a lot, you might get 30 hours a week. But then there were some weeks when they were down.
Looks like
you got to worry about your bus, yeah.
Yeah. Is there anything else you'd like to add to it?
What's that?
Is there anything else you'd like to add? Any last comment? Idea, thought?
Things you don't want to write about, probably. I mean, it was always a problem to get the University of Wisconsin's attention, and to pay attention to this place. They didn't realize what they had. I mean, it was, people came from all over the country and even world to use it. And they were stingy. When we needed office space for users, they couldn't do anything. Well, we finally got these trailers. But it almost took death threats to get those trailers. We could not get a building. Where do people stay when they come here? Well, they said there's a motel in Stoughton. Well, there is, but it went in receivership not too long after that. And there's a crummy one in Oregon, and crummy one in, I mean, the one in McFarland doesn't exist anymore. And so they might stay in Madison. And that's a lot of commuting, and it cost the experimenters big bucks to send people here. And they didn't have any sort of housing facility. And the only reason they got this one, I mean, the state said, we don't build housing, no matter what. And Cliff Olson, the guy who just died, he went to a dentist up here on the west side of Madison in a new strip mall. And he got curious who built that strip mall building. And it was built for peanuts on the scale that the state of Wisconsin builds things, because they have a purpose that they have to build things. And here, they just need a building like this one. Mm-hmm. And it was like pulling teeth to get this building built. And in fact, they weren't given enough money. The gypsum board here was probably put up by storage rig technicians, and they had a lookout posted because the union sent a guy out to see if they were putting up wallboard there. It's supposed to be done by union workers. And they worked Sundays, and they parked their cars somewhere else. And everything was done on a shoestring. And this housing facility was weird. It was a gift of the farmer across the street. The state solution was, well, when a building, we were going to close a low security prison, and maybe one of those buildings we could have brought down here and convert, you could convert it down. Just everything was done on a shoestring, and it's too bad. They really didn't pay attention to this place.
Yeah, I'd actually noticed that trend too. I'd noticed that as well when talking to Esther and things like that.
No, I mean, I was at another institution. I wrote letters to several deans, and I went and talked to the Shane was president, talked to them and told them, and, you know, I don't know what good it did, but it's probably not a good diplomatic thing for us to criticize the administration of another university, but I did it because, I mean, we were kind of desperate. We would even have review committees come in, and they would say, why don't you claim that what users from around the country, why don't you have housing for them?
That's great.
A place like Brookhaven has storage rooms that people come in. They've got a housing facility there. It was there for 50 years probably. They've got a cafeteria, snack bar, whole thing. And here, you're on your own. And the university did not do much. And some of the state law handicapped them, but some of it was just they didn't do much.
Do you think it improved since?
I don't know. Since I haven't been here, I haven't sent students. I retired in 2003, and or was it? Yeah, 2003. And Cliff lived up here, but I didn't send any students up here after that, so I don't really know how well it works. No, the housing facility works. Well, it's pretty far from a grocery store, and but there's, so I remember, I lived in it for 6 months, well, half time. And it's okay, but it was like pulling teeth to get it. And these, across the way, I mean, there's no toilet in any of them. They have to come here, even though there's a thunderstorm or something, and that's not very good.
All right.